the Madhyamika school. The perfection of wisdom sutras were associated with a particular school of Buddhism called the Madhyamika, which exposed the limitations of the basically psychological approach of the Abhidharma. The Abhidharmists thought that by analyzing their experience down to irreducible elements, they were getting to some kind of real bedrock. The perfection of wisdom showed that this bedrock was no bedrock at all. The Yogacara school. The other main Mahayana school is the Yogacara, which pointed out that one needed a drill piece to enable one to realize this fact for oneself. It balanced the philosophy of the Madhyamika with an approach based on the direct experience of meditation. The Yogacara school was founded by the 4th century scholar, Asanga. In middle age, Asanga retired to a cave to meditate on the image of Maitreya. After several years, he had still had no sign from Maitreya, so he decided to give up. Then, as he was making his way back to the great monastery of Nalanda, he saw a rock worn down by drops of water and the beating wings of birds. He went back to the cave and his meditation until 12 years had passed. Finally, he'd had enough. He came out again, and as he approached the city of Achinta, he came across a sick dog. The whole of its rump was an open sore, alive with maggots. Asanga pulled out his knife and cut a sliver of flesh from his own thigh. He then prepared to suck the maggots from the dog's rump and transfer them to this new home. At the last moment, he just had to close his eyes, when a sudden blaze of light made him open them again. Maitreya was standing before him in the form of a resplendent youth. "I was always there," said Maitreya, "but you could not see me until your will to enlightenment manifested." The dog barked joyfully, restored to health, and Asanga carried Maitreya on his shoulders into the town to give the people the blessing of a glimpse of the Bodhisattva. Of course, no one saw Maitreya, and only one old lady saw the dog. In this way, Maitreya is said to have passed on to Asanga the teachings of the Yogacara, which concluded that reality was mind only. It saw that what everything in the world has in common is that it is always illuminated by the mind perceiving it, through the senses. If the mind and its objects were fundamentally different in nature, then one would not recognize the other. However, if there is no real object apart from the mind, then there can be no perceiver apart from the mind either. Worship. Worship is an important activity in the Mahayana. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas embody the ideal of human development. What the Buddhists worship, therefore, is in a sense their own potential. What this means is that the devotional practices in Buddhism are just that. They are a practice, not a duty. For committed Buddhists, it is not enough to think about these ideas, or even just to study them. One has to also engage the emotions, and even the body. The most fundamental devotional practice is the sevenfold puja, a ceremony in 7 sections designed in its Mahayana form to lead to the rising of the will to enlightenment. For the Buddhist, it is a form of total expression involving the body, speech, and mind of commitment. By the 8th century, the practice of Mahayana Buddhism was concentrated in various well-endowed and often huge monasteries. The most famous of these, Nalanda, housed at least 10,000 monks and was more like a university, for it accommodated a good many non-Buddhists as well as monks of the Theravada tradition. However, these monasteries were losing touch with the common people, and a revival of Hinduism in India left Buddhism with few roots in its birthplace. Vajrayana, Diamond Vehicle, or Tantric Buddhism. The future of Buddhism lay, improbably, with individuals who, in the 9th to 12th centuries, walked out of the cozy scholastic monasteries and took to the road as mahasiddhas, or spiritual wizards, often accompanied by a female consort. They practiced ritual magic together with meditation, an esoteric practice that represented perhaps the most extraordinary of all developments in Buddhism. This is Tantric Buddhism, or as it later became, the Vajrayana, the way of the diamond thunderbolt. It had started in the monasteries on the basis, particularly, of a philosophy called the Tathagatagarbha, the womb of enlightenment doctrine, which arose in about the 3rd century. This was the idea that all beings are possessed of the seed of Buddhahood, and that all we have to do is wake up to our own true nature. The tantric initiate thus assumed the viewpoint of enlightenment itself. It was a startlingly daring innovation in Buddhist practice. At the same time, this overriding transcendental perspective distinguishes the Buddhist Tantra from the Hindu Tantra of the same period, in which magic could be used in the traditional way for secular ends. However, this renewal of Buddhism in India was brought to a brutal end in the 12th century, when Muslim invaders sacked the universities and put the monks in them to the sword. In doing so, they destroyed Buddhism in India at a stroke. Fortunately, well before this happened, the Mahayana had been transplanted to Central Asia and the Far East. Buddhism was well suited to expansion because of the absence of a central authority attempting to control the way it developed. And the Mahayana's emphasis on skillful means made it the ideal vehicle for the export of Buddhism. It grafted itself very easily onto the native culture, producing an extraordinary flowering of art wherever it went. The form in which it did this most vigorously was the Tantra, the Vajrayana, which traveled to China, Japan, and Mongolia, but was embraced with most spectacular success in Tibet. Tantric Buddhism took the philosophical developments of Buddhism and concentrated on putting these ideas into practice. The spiritual quality it emphasized, to go with wisdom and compassion, is energy. And the spiritual ideal it emphasized, on top of that of the Bodhisattva, is the Mahasiddha, the great adept. As always in Buddhism, the emphasis is on skill. But now it is skill in a kind of magic, in ritual action by which one unlocks and calls forth all the energies one can in the pursuit of the overriding purpose of attaining Buddhahood in this very life. The Tantra works with the idea that we have a seamless connection with the universe. It proposes that the reason one discriminates between mind and matter, purity and impurity, is because one sees distinct entities which, in fact, have no ultimate validity. Instead of things, the Tantra recognizes simply energy, which is either flowing or blocked, dissipated or concentrated, positive or negative. And energies on one level affect energies on other levels. Manipulating them involves a kind of spiritual magic, or what is perhaps more appropriately called spiritual technology. But whereas technologists and magicians manipulate and transform the world outside themselves, the tantric magician or technologist, through various rituals and exercises, is invoking powers and energies at the very deepest levels of the mind to achieve a transformation or reorganization of the whole way the world and him or herself is experienced. The Buddhist path traditionally does this in a process of gradually bringing more and more of oneself into the realm of consciousness. The Buddhist Tantra uses symbols and rituals to do this in a much more wholesale way. Actions, sounds, visual images resonate precisely at unconscious levels, stirring up specific energies and forces in the hidden depths of the mind. A sense of resonance, of vibrancy, is the overriding quality of all aspects of Tantric Buddhism. The Vajrayana vibrates with energy, color, sound, incense, activity, devotion, and stillness. A very straightforward example of this is the way an image of the Buddha communicates his message more clearly than words. It resonates with us at some level, and we respond to it. Something shifts within us. To take a more mundane example, there is a Japanese story about a rather ineffectual judo man who was told by his teacher just to meditate on the image of a great wave. So he did. He saw the wave gathering all the power of the ocean behind a deep green wall of water, driving to the shore with a composed insistence until at precisely the right moment it exploded irresistibly into the shingle of the beach. Needless to say, he was able to transform this image into his judo practice, developing powerful techniques. And that judo man became known as Great Wave. Tantric images work in this sort of way. Certain qualities are communicated at a non-rational level. Instead of a magic wand, the tantric initiate employs a vajra. With a wand, a frog may be transformed into a prince. With a vajra, the initiate's whole way of seeing is transformed, turned inside out. The vajra is a ritual implement in the shape of a thunderbolt. The vajrayana, or the tantra, provides a secret shortcut to enlightenment for those few whose compassionate resolve is not to be held up by the immeasurably long maturing process of the bodhisattva path. It is as if instead of slowly filling a balloon with helium and then slowly floating up, one were instead to create a gigantic controlled explosion of rocket fuel. However, a rocket is a lot more complicated than a balloon. Many of the tantras, the sutras of the Vajrayana, that describe this secret path, have now been published. But they remain secret because they cannot be practiced effectively without proper initiation and guidance. Some are dangerous, both psychically and spiritually. The tantra is particularly concerned with making use of energy which is physically and emotionally tied up with sexuality, though this, of course, is where much of our delusion and craving is actually centered. But if that energy can be refined and redirected with the help of the breath and the subtle channels of the nervous system, then extraordinary psychophysical energies become available to provide a shortcut to enlightenment. This is not really something to try at home. However, from the traditions of the West, one might identify Dante's love for Beatrice as having a certain tantric element to it. The passion that destroys Francesca da Rimini in the Inferno is the same passion that leads Dante himself to paradise. Tantra, the esoteric version of the three jewels. 1. The Buddha, the teacher or guru. In the Tantra, the three jewels or refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, have their esoteric versions. The esoteric version of the Buddha refuge is the teacher or guru. The Tibetan guru par excellence is Padmasambhava, an Indian Mahasiddha from Nalanda, who was brought to Tibet in the 8th century to subdue the local deities and establish the Dharma. So successful was he that he is revered in Tibet even more than the Buddha himself. He was somehow able to introduce the Dharma to a shamanistic society by making contact with the whole culture at an unconscious level. Of the four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism, he is the founder of the Nyingmapa lineage, the old school, characterized by an unconventionality and spontaneity that is found again in Zen Buddhism.
Always repeat to yourself, I do not have, I do not understand, I do not know. That is the heart of my advice.
Padmasambhava, known to the Tibetans as Guru Rinpoche, or Precious Guru, was said to have written scriptures which he hid away to be discovered when the time was right. Of these terma, or concealed scriptures. The most famous is the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Todol, which is a manual or guide to the passage between two lives. The root verses from this work are commonly recited and meditated upon.
Oh, now, when the intermediate state of the moment of death is dawning upon me, letting go of passion and attachment and longing for all worldly things, may I go undistracted into a clear awareness of the teachings and find release in the wombless space of the unborn mind. The hour is come when I must be severed from this body of flesh and blood. May I know this body as a journey of decaying to the grave. Oh, now, when the intermediate state of the reality is dawning upon me, letting go of all uprisings of terror and fear, may I know whatever appears to be projections of my own mind, may I know them as apparitions in the intermediate state. Arrived at this most critical moment, may I not fear my own visions of the peaceful and the wrathful ones. O procrastinating one, who sees not the coming of death, devoting yourself to the busy mindlessness of this life, so abject a blunder will it be to return empty-handed from this life. Since you are able here to recognize your real need, why do you not start to practice the Dharma right now? Listen to the words of the great adepts. If you do not cherish your teacher's advice, are you not just defrauding yourself?
Two, the Dharma. The Yidam, a visualized symbol of a tantric deity, and its mantra. As for the esoteric Dharma refuge, this is the Yidam, a visualized symbol of a tantric deity to which the devotee is linked through initiation, and which the devotee regularly meditates on thereafter, following a more or less complex visualization procedure. The image represents a luminous facet of the enlightened mind as it manifests itself in the brilliantly enhanced and subtle vision of the meditator. Corresponding to the image is a mantra, representing the same aspect of enlightenment or deity in oral form. In its earlier forms, the Vajrayana was known as the Mantrayana, and mantras were originally used as magic spells, for example, against snake bite. But, as the unutterable speech of the awakening heart, and repeated to oneself on a daily basis, they form an invisible wall of protection around the mind. What will strike even the most dispassionate observer of the Tibetan paintings based on these visualized deities, even in their most outlandish forms, is that they are intensely alive. They engage with us, confront us with their reality, even super-reality. Indeed, when they manifest themselves, they become at least as real as is the person visualizing them. However, crucial to any visualization practice is that it is in the end dissolved into the blue sky, representing shunyata, or emptiness. So they represent absolute reality in symbolic form, but they are not absolutely real themselves. Of all the archetypal bodhisattvas, the one who is seen as working closest to the coalface of human suffering is Avalokiteshvara, the Lord who looks down in compassion. As an archetypal bodhisattva, he manifests in all sorts of different forms. It is he who is said to appear as the different forms of Buddha in the various realms depicted in the Wheel of Life. And he it is who is presented as delivering the Heart Sutra. He is also supposed to appear in the form of the Dalai Lama, who is regarded by the Tibetan people as the literally incarnate Bodhisattva of compassion, one of a long line of successive reincarnations. His title means the teacher who is great like the ocean. It was originally conferred by the Mongol emperor in the 16th century on the head of the Gelugpa school, and the same source of power helped a subsequent Dalai Lama in the 17th century to assume temporal rule of the whole of Tibet. What this does not mean is that the Dalai Lama has spiritual authority over Tibet. Indeed, an earlier emperor, Kublai Khan, offered such power to his own guru, the head of the Shakyapa school, and the offer was instantly rejected. The legend of how Avalokiteshvara developed perhaps his most distinctive form is that he once made a vow to bring all the people of the land of snows out of the travails of samsara, and that if he ever hesitated in his resolve, even for a moment, then he would split asunder into 1,000 pieces. So the time came when he did stop to look at what he had managed to achieve so far. And of course, the whole point of the Bodhisattva vow to save all sentient beings is that it cannot be sustained as a personal achievement. So Avalokiteshvara just exploded into little pieces. Because this was the final shattering of his sense of self, Amitabha, the Buddha of compassion, was able to stick him together so that he had 1,000 arms and 11 heads. And this is the form in which he is often visualized. Three, the Sangha, the Dakini. If Bodhisattvas in their mythic form represent for the Vajrayana the esoteric version of the Dharma, then the esoteric version of the Sangha is the Dakini. This is the sky-dancing demoness, a wild and aroused, disheveled and naked mythical figure representing the ideal of spiritual communication and inspiration and fascination with the Dharma. The historical figure who is most closely associated with the quality of inspiration represented by the Dakini is the 11th century Tibetan yogi, guru and poet, Milarepa. He was first trained as a black magician in order to revenge his mother, who had been cheated out of her inheritance. In the end, Milarepa had half a village crushed by bringing a house down on his enemies, so that when remorse hit him, he realized he would have to gain complete enlightenment or face a long season in hell. "My religion," he said later, "is to live and die without regret." Then one day he saw the man who would be his guru ploughing a field. This was Mapa. Milarepa asked for initiation and instead was put to building work. Every day Mapa would come and look at what he had built and then furiously tell him to pull it down. Mapa beat him and insulted him until Milarepa had got through much of the bitter fruit of his evil deeds. Finally, Mapa adopted him as his spiritual heir. Though, as with the greatest teachers, his disciple did not imitate his personality or way of life in the least detail. Whereas Mapa had been married, Milarepa spent the rest of his life in solitude, eating little more than nettles. And unlike Mapa, he became the gentlest and kindest of teachers, famous for his songs of instruction.
To quiet the mind, just let it go. Be effortless, like a sleeping child or the wide, still sea. In illumination, rest like a lamp in the night. Then how to deal with wandering thoughts? Wild clouds cannot split from the wide blue sky. Great waves cannot leap from the deep green sea. Thick fog cannot stand divided from the air. And the mind run mad cannot run from voidness.
Buddhism in China and Japan, the Pure Land, Jodo Shinshu, and Chan, or Zen. In China, Buddhism gradually seeped in from the 1st century AD, and it was able to take advantage of the collapse of the northern part of the Chinese Empire in 320 AD. The Huns in the north welcomed Buddhism because the Confucians of the south regarded it as un-Chinese and barbarian. The southerners also welcomed Buddhism as their cultural complacency was challenged politically, and as the new religion lost its Indian connection, which had come from the north. While many of the schools of Buddhism found a home, however temporary, somewhere in China, the Chinese developed two major indigenous schools of Buddhism, which both reflected their practical, intuitive spirit. This appealed on a popular level. The most popular was the Pure Land School, which was based on faith. This projected a paradise, a pure Buddha field. All that is required to be reborn in this pure land is a moment of faith. One was invited to let go and rely on the compassion of Amitabha, the mythic Buddha of compassion. The Pure Land School came to Japan in the 10th century, and as developed by Shinran Shonin, Shonin meaning saint, became in the 13th century the Jodo Shinshu. The main practice is the recitation of the Nembutsu, the recitation of the name of Amida, the Japanese version of Amitabha. Though it was only in China that the path of faith became a separate school, this approach comes from Nagarjuna himself.
To discipline oneself is difficult, whereas to proceed by means of faith is easy. Those who wish to reach the stage of non-retrogression quickly should have a mind filled with reverence and pronounce the Buddha name, always bearing it in mind.
This has made Jodo Shinshu immensely successful. As Shinran interprets it, the Pure Land is not out there, attendant on some act of faith at all. It is Buddhahood itself, and it is ours already. When one awakens to Amida's compassion, when one surrenders to the so-called other power, there is no more distinguishing between self and other anyway. This is not as easy as it sounds, of course, because any self-conscious act of surrender would again be an attempt to get something by one's own egotistic efforts. In this way, faith and wisdom come to the same thing. The other major new tradition of the Far East was one of self-power, the way of Chan in China or Zen in Japan. It too was concerned with getting directly to the point, but from a different direction. The legendary beginnings of this tradition go back to the Buddha himself. He was said to have initiated the transmission of this teaching when he gathered the monks together and, instead of giving a talk, just sat silently before them. Then, reaching out from where he was sitting, he picked a flower and held it up before the company of monks. They all assumed he was going to start talking about impermanence or drawing out some elaborate simile based on this charming image. However, all of a sudden, it was all over. The Buddha said,
"I hold a key to the gateless gate of the Dharma. I now pass it to Mahakashyapa."
Mahakashyapa was revered for his strictness, his practice of meditation, his faith and devotion, his compassion for the poor and downtrodden, and his short temper. He alone got the point, and in course of time he passed the transmission to Ananda. In the early 6th century, an Indian monk called Bodhidharma, who was the 28th in the line of transmission, came to China. He was the first patriarch of Chan, meaning the way of meditative concentration. The Chan, or as it became in Japan, Zen tradition, is neatly characterized in an anonymous Chinese verse.
A special transmission outside the scriptures. No dependence upon words and letters. Direct pointing to the mind. Seeing into one's own nature and realizing Buddhahood.
These characteristics were developed by the 6th patriarch, Hui Neng, in the 8th century. He was illiterate, but first awoke to the truth in his local market when he overheard a monk reciting the Diamond Sutra. The Zen school which he established was a brilliant and dramatic recreation of the Buddha's teaching. There are two main traditions of Zen: the Southern school, Rinzai, and the Gradual school, Soto. The Southern school focuses on the moment of awakening, while the Soto school focuses on practice as an end in itself. What particularly characterizes the Rinzai school is the koan, a kind of spiritual riddle.
"All things are of the nature of mind," said the monk. "What? Even this rock?" said Master Hogen. "Then your mind must be very heavy."
In this way, Master Hogen challenges the monk to look directly into the reality of the mind. The special transmission of Zen is simply the living spirit of Buddhism, which is the communication of the Sangha at the most uncompromising level. One has to begin with intense reverence for the scriptures and for the Buddha, intense meditation practice, and moral discipline. It is on the basis of these that the iconoclastic spirit of Zen works. Many koans are concerned with the semi-mythical figure of Bodhidharma.
Why did Bodhidharma come from the West?
Having meditated on the koan, the student tries to test his understanding of it in an encounter with his own teacher. However, a koan is necessarily insoluble. It is held in the concentrated mind of the meditator like a grain of sand in an oyster, becoming more and more of a burden. The conscious mind tries to get rid of it, as it tries to get rid of all suffering. But it cannot. This practice is said to require great faith, great determination, and great doubt. This is what Master Mumon said of the practice.
Your body should be solid doubt. Day and night, dig into the koan, but do not see it as nothingness, or being, or non-being. Let it become a red-hot iron ball you have swallowed and cannot throw up. Then, suddenly, the koan will split open, astonishing the heavens and shaking the earth.
It should not be thought that Zen is very different from the Buddha's own way of teaching. Once, the Buddha was being pestered while on his alms round by a man called Bahiya, who wanted to be ordained. Eventually, the Buddha turned around, and what he said caused his follower to awaken on the spot.
In the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the sensed, only the sensed. In the thought, only the thought.
The Soto Zen school of gradual awakening is in its own way no less uncompromising, especially as described by its greatest master, Dogen.
To practice the way single-mindedly is in itself enlightenment. There is no gap between practice and enlightenment, Zazen and ordinary life.
Zazen is just sitting still, and it is the whole of the practice. There is no goal projected into the future, because this would falsify the practice. It would split the mind into now and later. There is just sitting, without either thinking or its opposite, not thinking.
Studying the Buddha way is studying oneself. Studying oneself is forgetting oneself. Forgetting oneself is being enlightened by all beings.
Such are the main developments of Buddhism in the East. The 20th century has been disastrous for Buddhism in China and Mongolia, where it has been virtually eliminated. The Chinese are in the process of eliminating it from Tibet. However, there has been a resurgence of Buddhism in India, amongst the ex-untouchable community, and it has now come to the West. Buddhism in the West. How it will develop in the West cannot yet be seen. It is early days. If the past is anything to judge by, it will be very different from what has gone before. Indeed, the only way that the living spirit of Buddhism can survive is if the forms it takes change to follow the distinctive curves of the cultural landscape in which it finds itself. In the West, as in China nearly 2,000 years ago, a well-established religion is confronting a well-established culture. As in China, the initial progress of Buddhism in the West has been slow and hesitant. Since the 1960s, however, there has been something of a breakthrough. There are literally thousands of different schools of Buddhism in Europe and the Americas, many with their own monasteries or retreat centers. Some are just local groups, and some are worldwide and well-organized movements. Some of these sanghas are conservative, sticking closely to an established tradition from Tibet or Japan. Others are more radical and experimental. What is common to all of them is a recognition that Buddhism is not, as it appears, an oriental phenomenon at all. The Dharma is, as the Buddha himself said, of the nature of an invitation. What appears to be Buddhism is simply the Sangha keeping that invitation open. As for what one is really being invited to, this can only be known in the stillness and the fire of practice.
Etena saccha vacena otu me jaya mangala.
Just as the mighty ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, so the Dharma has but one taste, the taste of freedom.